Hey everyone, welcome back to the Career Growth Podcast. For our regular listeners, I might sound a little different. That's because I'm not Kalis. And Kalis today is taking a backseat from being a host and is going to be a producer on the show today. Don't worry, this is very temporary. He'll be back as a host next week and you'll hear from him soon. And anyone that listened to a first season, my voice might sound a bit more familiar. I used to be a co-host on the podcast in the first season. And I'm back just for a short episode. And today with me, I have an amazing guest. She has been working with us for a little while. And one of my colleagues has been raving about her for it's been a few months now. And she keeps saying, you have to get her on the podcast. And so today with me, we have Beatrice Cord from Endeavor. And how are you doing today, Beatrice?
Hey, I'm doing really well. Thank you. And thank you for having me.
No problem at all. So... For the purpose of our guest, I'll just kind of briefly introduce your background. I'll just touch upon a few things. And at the same time, I don't want to kind of fully go over your background. So Beatrice is someone who has got two undergrad degrees, went to grad school, and started working in L'Oreal, then went on to being an advisor to her country's mission at the UN, and so on and so on and so on. And obviously, I'll let Beatrice kind of go through all those things. It's actually a really, really impressive background. So without me kind of explaining your background, could you just like briefly walk us through your career in your 20s and what that entailed?
That's so funny. Walking here, I was listening to this song of Miley Cyrus. I know I used to be crazy, but that's because I used to be young. And it's a song that really represents, I feel like, me and where I am right now in my life, which is like mid-30s. My early 20s were about exploration. So I did a lot of things, but that was because my mantra was try everything and really go and, you know, taste a little bit of like every different career path or interest that I had at that point. So initially I wanted to work in advertising. That was my big dream in high school. So I went to the advertising school in Romania, and, you know, it was in collaboration with Leo Burnett, which was a huge advertising company, like globally, especially in the US. Sure. And I had like my very, very first job was in PR, in a, you know, small PR and advertising company. And it lasted like for probably like a month or something, because I don't know. I had to like write a press release for the entire time. And I was like, this is crazy. I can't do this for like my, so that's how I got to L'Oreal, where I was doing like a little bit more like marketing and like a bunch more creative work. And in parallel, I was also studying law because my parents thought advertising PR is not the real job. And, you know, like 15, 20 years ago, it wasn't really like people weren't talking about this career, especially like PR and communications. My mom at some point asked me, so do you want to like talk to people? Like what's this whole like communication idea, right? So I was studying law, and you know, at some point I got really frustrated because I just wanted more. The crisis came, like the budgets were cut. So I was like, okay, I want to go and study in the UK, in London. There's where like I completely changed my mind about PR and advertising, and I started, and also like marketing. Although I still think they're like incredible things to do, for me, it was just like, it's a bit too superficial. I want to go deeper. I want to see like what I can do more. So I went a little bit like towards diplomacy, and I started like kind of like playing with this idea of like being a diplomat. I studied diplomacy. I then came to New York to work for the United Nations. That was my dream job. Not because I thought the United Nations is like the best. I think it has like a lot of goods and a lot of bads. And, I was doing my entire thesis on the bads, actually, like on what the United Nations is not, you know, achieving. So I wanted to do multilateral diplomacy. For me, that was like why I really wanted to be here. I came here, I worked as a, you know, as a diplomat, as an advisor for the Romanian mission. And then I started working for the UN, organizing what is called the Youth Assembly at the UN, one of the biggest platforms for young people all over the world to come and understand what the UN is. And then from there, I kind of like transitioned into more of a consultancy role, doing a lot of like youth empowerment and nation branding type of platforms and events around the world. It was fantastic because I got to be like, you know, why I wanted to be a diplomat was mainly because I wanted to understand, to travel, to discover the world. So sure. In this consulting role, I actually got to do a lot of that. So, you know, I went to Saudi Arabia when Saudi Arabia was completely closed. You couldn't visit as a tourist. I went to, you know, a lot of the other countries in the Middle East. I went to Latin America, to Europe, back to Europe. I'm originally from Europe. So I think that's always been like a little bit of like my desire to be between the two continents. Sure. And it was great because I got to do these incredible conferences to connect people. And, you know, the more I was doing it, the more like my desire to do more on my own started like happening. So it was like a natural transition at some point when I was like about to turn 30, like towards the end of my 20s, to really go into entrepreneurship and try different things on my own. And I did that for a while. And now I am working for Endeavor. And what I kind of like to say is like I'm an entrepreneur turned intrapreneur, because an Endeavor is a global organization supporting, it's by for high impact entrepreneurs. So basically we're supporting, selecting, you know, helping entrepreneurs from especially emerging markets, but not only, to really like, you know, do their magic and to have this multiplier effect and to really like change their economy. So that's a little bit about, you know, my 20s transitioning into my 30s and how.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for that. Okay, we're going to kind of go through some of those in a bit more detail. So when I last did the podcast, a lot of the hosts, a lot of the guests that I had on the podcast rather, were entrepreneurs. And so it's great to have someone who perhaps had like a slightly more traditional background. And so I'm really intrigued. I have a lot of questions for you, Beatrice, and it's going to be interesting. So for anyone that's not familiar with my background, I studied law. So there's a little bit of an overlap. When you kind of went through your background, there's a few things that I was like, oh, okay, there's quite a lot of similarities here. So I studied law, didn't complete it. I started the company with my co-founder in our first year, towards the end of first year. And then we dropped out towards the end of our third year. So, and then we've been working on CP since 2012, so it's been 12 years. So I'm practically unemployable at this stage. So it's great to see kind of someone who has gone through different roles, and I have so many questions, so we'll come to that. So to kind of go back a little bit and rewind to kind of your career LB and L'Oreal and your UN, so I would probably say that's probably like your beginning or like mid-20s. So a lot of our listeners would love to know, what was the kind of process of getting into organizations like that, because I think I would probably say LB and L'Oreal are probably kind of like private companies and obviously similar in a lot more ways than someone like being an advisor to your country's mission to the UN. So by the way, on that topic, did you have a diplomatic passport, by the way? I only heard about this. Oh, okay.
Not yet, because I wasn't like, by the time I would have gotten my passport, I left.
Oh, okay. Oh, shame.
Diplomatic visa, which is pretty much the same.
Okay, sure. For anyone that's not familiar, do you want to just tell them what a diplomatic passport is or a diplomatic visa is?
Yeah, I mean, it's when you're a diplomat for your country, when you represent your country, you basically do not belong to any of the countries where you work in. So, for example, if you work in the US, you have this diplomatic passport or diplomatic visa, which means that you don't, normally when you come to the US, you need a tourist visa or a working visa, and that's given by the US, right? By the US
state. Yeah.
On a diplomatic visa is an agreement between the countries, especially with the UN. So UN is almost like a country in a city. So the UN building is its own neutral space. It doesn't belong to the US. It's just on US grounds. And having this passport means that you don't pay taxes. You have like a separate line in the airport. You probably all saw that line for like diplomatic personnel, like, you know, people. It is just like easier because you don't have to pay taxes here, you don't have to file taxes, you don't have to, but then like a lot of other things, right? You don't have a social security in that country because you do not work for that country, you just work in that country, but you completely belong to either your country or the international organization. You also have a diplomatic passport if you work for the UN. So you can work for the UN and also get one. It's
pretty cool. As in like the concept, I think the whole-
Why stuff cheaper?
Yeah, like I think it's a lot harder to- Yeah, the taxes, I think the police will treat you very differently as well, right?
Yeah, they can stop you, but if you show the diplomatic passport, they're not allowed to like fine you. They have to report you back to the police of your country in a way. So then you kind of like, so you're a little bit exempt, obviously, if like bad things happen or if you go, but like if they just stop you because you were driving too fast, they cannot actually like fine you.
I'm sure the number of people that just search for diplomatic passports just shot up on Google. So thank you so much for that. So anyway, I kind of got sidetracked there. So coming back to your early 20s. So do you remember the process that you kind of went through? And it would be great for a lot of our listeners to kind of like, obviously, I fully assume that some of the processes might have changed, but what was it like applying to organizations like LB, L'Oreal, and then we'll come to the UN completely separately, or at least your mission, your country's mission to the UN?
So just a caveat, I didn't work for the LB. It was just like they had a partnership with my university. So it was like the university was under him. I worked for another advertising company that I'm not even sure they're around because a lot of them have been bought up and so on. I did work for WPP, which is the biggest conglomerate in like advertising communications and so on. What was like, it's very interesting. So the first job in PR that I got, first of all, I studied during my university. So I was studying and working at the same time, which is something that I don't know how it is in Romania. You can do that. I think in the US it's much harder, but in Romania you can 100% combine them. I mean, it's a lot of work. I used to like sleep very, very little, but I did work while I was studying. So I was like early 20s when I had my first job in PR. And these were my first real jobs. I had other jobs before I got to university. I won't go into those because those are just like make money. So my first job in PR, I think I got it honestly through participating in different networking type of events and meeting people and then, you know, applying for these internship opportunities. I think when you're in school, it's actually super cool because it's very easy to get into an organization through an internship, right? Most of the companies
easier, I'll probably say.
So they're not paying internships, but they're looking for the talent. So they're willing to like open up because they need a talent. Even now I'm looking for interns for the summer because it's fantastic. Like they're super smart. They're willing to like prove themselves. And, you know, it's a great opportunity to have like a lot of the work that you need to have done. So I think I always say it's probably easier to get into an organization, especially like these like bigger corporations or so on when you're super young and then like grow from there, which is something I didn't do. I have a lot of friends who, you know, got into incredible positions just by the fact that they started as an intern and then just stuck with the organization. And, you know, naturally they progressed to incredible executive levels. So that's what I did. I love networking. I've always loved meeting people, talking to people. And that, you know, from a very early age, I was pretty like outgoing. And I remember like I met the person who was running this organization or like she was like one of the leaders of the organization, of the PR company in a student type of conference. And then, you know, she published the job. I applied. I had an interview with her. So it was like the whole process. I got that. And then the L'Oreal thing in Romania at that point, the job fairs started coming. So you started having these companies, you know, coming to campuses and just like, which is 100% something that is still very, very strong, even now in the US. But I think it's also like getting more stronger in other parts of the world. And Romania was kind of like slow into that. But yeah, I went to a job fair and there was this booth of L'Oreal and this person who was presenting L'Oreal. And I remember like I already had a job. So that's a very funny story because I already had this job with a PR, but all of my colleagues didn't have a job and they were desperate. L'Oreal is a great employer. To be honest, it's a great place to learn and to grow. So they were desperate to get a job with L'Oreal. And I was like not even interacting with the guy because I already had a job. So I was just there to support my friends. And I was like kind of like sitting there and he was like, what about you? And I was like, oh, no, I already have a job. He's like, well, maybe you want to still apply. I was like, no, I have my dream job because I thought that was my dream job to work in PR and in advertising, right? And they're like, well, we have positions in PR and advertising too. So maybe you want to apply. No, I'm fine. Don't worry. So I completely like blew it. Like I was like, no, I'm super cool. I don't need you. And then I went, I started this job, but like, he still gave me his card or something. He was like, well, if anything happens, cause I was in my first year of university. So he thought maybe in your second year or whatever. So he gave me his card and then I went on, I started my dream job and my dream job proved to be like not dreamy at all. As I said, I mean, it was great. I just didn't feel. And when you're so young, I feel like it's really like my advice is don't stay. When you're super young, the world is yours. So don't stay in anything that's not feeling like right. So I called the guy. I was like, hi, do you still have the position? Because I want it. He's like, well, we don't have the PR and you know, the PR one, we do have the marketing one. And I remember I went in and I had, like, he set me up, like I had the first interview with him. He was a human resources person. And then he set me up with the director of the, like, there was this small kind of like department. he basically set me up with him. And it was like, he became my mentor. It was one of the most incredible interviews of my life. And he was also like the person who encouraged me to like leave the organization and go study and do other things. And, you know, I kept meeting him throughout my career. He was this French guy, super creative. His office was like full of like old like hair things, because it was like the department was about like hair products.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I completely loved it. And I joined this organization it wasn't even an internship. It was actually like a real job, a junior job, but like a real job, because they were launching a new product and they just needed someone to do it. And yeah, I loved it. I did fashion shows. I did like a bunch, like a new magazine. It was like an amazing run. I met some incredible people that I still am in contact with. And I remember when I was going to work every day and my colleagues were like, "You're so young." I was like 21 or something. And they were like, "You're studying. Like, why are you working? Like, you shouldn't be here. You should be like studying." And I was like, "No," because I started in the summer. So it was supposed to like be a summer type of thing, but then I just kept going.
Sure.
And they were like, "Yeah, like, you know, I just kept going because I loved it." And at some point, my mom was super afraid that I was missing my school because of working like full time. And I remember she would come next to the building and she would be like, "I'm just gonna go there and say like you're not allowed to work." And I was like, "Mom, I'm over 21, so you cannot really do anything." But yeah, I really love that. But that's how I did it, like networking, fairs, meeting people, and just, you know, putting yourself out there. I must say, I never really applied for a job directly in like LinkedIn, for example. I mean, yes, I've applied, but it wasn't ever something that actually worked out. I feel like for me, it was always like meeting people, you know, that somehow lead you into like that role, or like figuring out like, "Oh, I love this organization. Who do I know from this organization that I can, you know, talk with?" So I think like for me, that's, and it kept working. I think that was not just in my 20s. It was like all throughout my life.
It gives you a slight advantage, right? Because knowing someone and having someone internally that could potentially vouch for you and say, "Oh, I've met Beatrice and she was quite impressive and she completely blew me off, but I think we should still kind of speak to her." So,
I mean, to be honest, it's one of those things, right? Like you receive, and even now with AI, I think it's even worse, like hundreds of applications, right? Like they're like piles and piles of CVs. Some people just like go through them with some AI, app. So like, how do you decide? I am now in the process of selecting interns and, you know, interviewing interns. And it's super hard. Like if you don't know them just through, and now it's, you don't even meet them in person, right? Cause it's like mainly Zoom calls. Like, how do you decide? How do you feel like they're the right vibe, or like they fit, especially when you're that young? I was actually discussing about this. You have pretty much nothing. You just have your youth, and that's perfectly fine. But that's where it becomes like harder to figure out, okay, like, why this person and not that person? They're both, you know, they're both studying. They're both great at what they're studying and like enthusiastic and young and fresh. And so like, how do you differentiate between this person and that person? So like when you meet someone, you get to like feel that person's vibe and like their personality and like whether or not they're passionate. And, you know, like you get to understand a little bit more about them, especially at that early age. Cause like afterwards, sure, you build a portfolio, you build a CV, you build like a lot of like background that supports you in an application. But when you're 20, you don't really have much, you know? Like,
yeah, there's nothing that separates you, because this is one of the things that one of my professors said in my first semester. He basically said, "Vinay, turn around and look at this lecture theater. There's 300 people here. There's nothing that differentiates you from other person here." And so I completely agree. And obviously being on the hiring side, but this is where small things can set you apart, like sending like a really nice follow-up email after
for
a call,
sure.
And or like just meeting them in person at a networking event, keeping in touch. But I think also with things like LinkedIn, it's gone a bit crazy as well, because if I go speak somewhere, I probably get like 50 connection requests straight after that, and it's just a bit crazy. But I know that we have another overlap, because you worked on an MGF project back in 2016, 17, 18, one of those few years, right? So in Saudi Arabia, which must have been very different, because I spoke at that event in 2022, so 2 years ago. And Saudi,
pride and joy, because I've started that program as a program director. I did the very first MGF.
Oh, wow. That's
extremely like proud, because it grew. So, I mean, it's not because of me, but it's just like, you know, when you start something and you see that growing so beautifully, you're always like, I'm so happy.
It was crazy. So in 2022, when we were doing it, it was at a royal palace and it was a 2-day thing and 20,000 students and young people attended it. And I must have spoken to, I felt like I spoke to 20,000 people at that day by the end of those 2 days, but it was insane. And so anyway, we'll come to that. But just going over some of the things that you just briefly mentioned. So you said you're a huge advocate for switching jobs and trying different things in your 20s, especially if things are not kind of looking from the outside, you might have a perception of a company or an opportunity, but when you're working inside, it's usually very different to how you perceive it. And and I also want to bear in mind something that you said with your colleagues. Some of them start off as interns or in graduate roles within that company and kind of just work their way up. So with those two kind of approaches, what are your thoughts and what would you kind of generally say in terms of advice to people in their 20s who are kind of not sure if they want to stick it through and potentially get a promotion in 6 months, 12 months, or go somewhere else and perhaps the grass may not be greener?
Yeah, it's so interesting. I think it's a personality. It starts with your personality, right? Like, and it's also like, obviously, how risk adverse you are. Again, you're an entrepreneur, so you probably are very risk adverse. And as I said, I've never really been, like, I feel like I've never really wanted like a super clear or like corporate, my parents are entrepreneurs. I think it's worth saying that. I grew up with entrepreneurs in a very entrepreneurial type of environment. They started their business pretty much when I was born. I didn't really want to go into entrepreneurship because I saw how hard it is.
I don't blame you.
It wasn't just hard. It was just like one of those things like life and death every day. So for me, it was like, wow, like, no, I actually wanted to take, for me, like the career side was the safer bet, especially at the beginning. And it was also like a little bit of like, as you said, right? Like you're unemployed, but that's exactly what my parents say. Like for them, it's like, it's either the business is going to work or we have nothing, right? So for me, it was a little bit like, I want to have more chances to explore more before I get to a point where I commit fully to something that I actually want to build or I, you know, want to be committed in. But like having that in mind, so my brain was always like, I am going to go out there to find like the best thing. And if I don't find the best thing, I know that eventually I want to become an entrepreneur. So I know that eventually I want to, like, if I do stick to something, it's going to be something that I built, right? So I think that's like the type of mentality that helped me be very, you know, change and flexible. And generally, like, yeah, like I did have a bunch of moments when, you know, I was never like, I never got to like, I don't know, president of a company because I stuck around 6 years. Obviously you advance when you change roles, but it's always like harder to get like those like super high level positions, right? And I did have friends that stuck with an organization for 3-4 years. And by the time we were like 25 or 26, they're like executive director, right? And I had moments when I was like, oh, maybe I should have done the same. Maybe I should have like stuck to different organizations. Now in retrospect, because it's beautiful when you're able to look in retrospect, for me, this worked because I never, my mantra was like, don't wake up with a regret that you didn't do that. Like, don't wake up at 40 and feel like, wow, I really wish I would have gone. And when I took the diplomacy internship, it started as an internship here in New York. I was working for like a super strong Petrom OMV, which was a super strong corporation in Romania that, you know, was oil and gas, like was pretty much one of the best places to work in at the time. And in front of me was this beautiful career that I could have done with them, right? And I remember like, when I left, the director that I was working with was like, whoa, like we want to offer you a position. We want to like, you know, have you and grow and blah, blah. So if you go, maybe you go for 3 weeks, but then you come back. And I never came back. And I always like, I didn't regret it, but I always thought like, if I would have gone back, I would have had a very different, you know, career trajectory. So I think it depends. Like my advice is like to really try to know yourself as much as possible. There are a lot of people that, by the time they're 14, they know exactly what they want to do. So for them, it's like much easier because they know like, oh, I want to work in oil and gas or in advertising or I want to build my own company. So it's very easy. They know it. I think I thought I knew, but then every time I went into something and I realized like, well, I don't like this or this is not what I thought it is. Like there was this voice in my head that was like, okay, like, you don't have to stay here. You can just go and try something else. So like you build like a little bit of these muscles of I feel like facing your fears of changing? Because it is, sure. It's always like, you're always like starting from scratch with a new team, a new company, a new position, a new, but also like being excited. Like for me, it was also the excitement of like something new. I'm going to meet new people. I'm going to have like a new exposure to new environment. And yeah, like for me, like that's what it was. And it still is. I feel like even now, like I don't think I would ever stay just for the sake of staying and hoping that in the 6 years or 10 years, I will get to like a certain position. I think for me, it's more like, what's my experience? What I'm learning? Who am I working with? Am I not waking up happy every morning, but am I excited about what I'm doing?
Sure. Yeah. That's really important.
Yeah. Find your why. I think it's really find your why and then try to like respond that why as much as you can, as best as you can. That's my advice.
Sure. So on that note, so when do you know it's the right time to move?
Oh, this is such a great question. I was in a conference, in a like whatever video call with this incredible writer, and she was talking about, you know, like this society is encouraging us to stay, to keep going, to be resilient, right? And it's like leaving anything, a job, a relationship, a country, is always seen a little bit like you're giving up, unless you're leaving because you have another opportunity that's, you know, bringing you to like a better level.
Either you failed or you're a traitor.
Exactly. So it's always hard to leave because she was saying that basically studies shown that by the time we make the decision to leave, we are already like around 6 months later than when we were supposed to actually leave. But like our brain didn't like process that for like 6 months. So when do you know? For me, it's always like now, again, in retrospect. Then I did a lot of the decisions were just like out of like, oh no, I want this and I have an opportunity would present itself. So that's a very different scenario when like literally you get like another opportunity and you're like, okay, do you want this? Take it. And then you leave because you want to take that. Or like just like you feel inside like something is not good. And you like keep feeling that for long enough. Like I did, like I had one job that was an amazingly paid job in New York. It was super cool in like tech and so on. I was like waking up, I don't know, not feeling it. Like I didn't want to wake up every day. And I knew like this is a great job. It's a super well paid. I have an executive position, all of that, right?
But on like paper, it's great.
On paper, it's great. But like I was not like, I didn't feel like, that's what I'm supposed to do. And I remember like I said it out loud to a friend. And then like in a few days after that, like, you know, I had a conversation with the founder and like everything like pretty much like fell into place. Cause I really believe like once you're able to like vocalize what you want to do, somehow the universe, you know, comes around and either pushes you to do it, you know, like you get fired or, you know, something happened or like really like helps you to do it. You know, like another opportunity comes along or something, you know, something else. So I think it's two ways. Like you either like, but it's hard because if you don't know that you want to go, then you're not going to look for other opportunities, right? So like you kind of have to like decide and either put it on paper or say it out loud or, you know, make a little bit of a commitment and then just look for, or either look or just be open, you know, like open up for new opportunities. Like LinkedIn, for example, you can put that, you know, open for opportunities or something tag in your photo. Like that's like a sign, a very clear sign for everyone.
Your thoughts, I would love to ask you about this. What if one of your colleagues put that up while they're still working at Endeavor?
Oh yeah, that would be weird. I've never, every time I left, I already had something else that I was living to, right?
Sure. So I think that's a good idea, right?
Only when I left to start my own thing, I had nothing and I was leaving and we'll see. And that was terrifying. I think it's terrifying when you leave and there's like really, you have no idea what you're leaving to.
It's like jumping off a cliff, right?
I felt like for a few days, I was like, I don't know, I couldn't even speak. I felt like, oh my God. Like it just gets so... Yeah, I don't know. Like I've never really put that on LinkedIn. I do think during these days, you know, there's so much layovers in big companies, in tech companies, like there's so much happening. And I always appreciate the courage of people to come up there and say like, I'm leaving this or I've been laid off. Yeah. And, you know, this is what I am good at. Like, if you know, I think you need so much courage. I don't know if I would be able to do that.
Yeah, I agree.
I respect this. I feel like it's a development of our society of which vulnerability is no longer like seen as a bad thing. It's starting to be seen as a as a courage. And I think the generation coming, by the way, they're really gonna change the game. I mean, I've heard like crazy things from people like just not showing up to their jobs the second day without saying anything just because they didn't like it. And I mean, like very young people to sure. like, you know, people showing up and being like, hey, like, I don't like this. Like, I need to change this, or I want more from this. Or so I think they're really like coming up with like great, brave ideas of how to like.
I think they're very courageous, right? I think I feel like they have a lot more courage and they're a lot more outspoken than the previous generations. I think if they don't like something, they're not happy. That's something they're not happy about. They're very vocal about it and they're not afraid to talk about it. And I think that's a really good thing.
It's also because, so my parents are an exception in their generation because they're entrepreneurs. But basically that generation, and especially the generation before them, those are generation of people that finished school, got a job, stayed in a job, retired from the job. That was it. Even my parents, I mean, they started this business. They stayed in the business. Like maybe they would have been like, maybe a new entrepreneur would have like stopped and done different businesses 5 times, right? Like they just stuck. Sure. Because they're like, this is what we know how to do. This is what we're going to do. So they were not necessarily that flexible. They didn't really understand this concept of like my parents have employees that have been there for like 20 something years. Mm. And like, that's pretty much like the generation. So I feel like our generation, we've started doing a little bit of like jumping around, moving, changing jobs, being like a bit more flexible. And like, of course, sure. the generation that comes, you know, after us was like a lot of their like, their parents also have been more courageous. And there's also like a little bit of a safety net
sure.
Because they're able to like, you know, give them a little bit more security. I mean, I expect my daughter to like, don't take no for an answer in any, and like never say, like she's 2 now, but so she has a lot. But like, because, you know, I'm her model in a way, right? Like I'm the one sure. setting up. So like, how am I going to be like, oh no, you have to stay and like stick to this because, or like stick to this school or stick to this job because that's going to be good. Like, I won't be able to say that. I didn't do that. So I won't be able to tell her like to do that. So I think that's why they're becoming much more courageous because they do have other role models. And also like we've seen, I mean, there's this book, it's an amazing book. It's called The Portfolio Life. And it really talks about exactly this, like we're a whole new generation. You don't have to be just a doctor or just a lawyer or just like, whatever you are in a career that you've studied, you can be pretty much anything that you want to be based on your what you're good at, what your skills are, but also what your passion and your interest is. So, sure. you know, for me, if you look at my career, like what is she? I studied law, but I also studied diplomacy, but I also studied like PR and advertising. I worked in consultancy, I worked in diplomacy, I worked in tech, and I did my own company, and now I work as, you know, in partnerships. Like it's all over the place. You cannot really like find like a red link between all of them and say like, oh, this is why it makes sense. But it does make sense for me. And I feel like all the skills added up. And also like, I feel like, you know, because I've done so many different things, something, and even now I also teach. I forgot to say that, but I'm an executive course facilitator for Stanford and I teach design thinking. I love it. I literally love it. It's one of like the best things that I've, you know, started doing for like a few years now. But it's okay. It's okay to not just be one thing or associated with one part of your life or your career. And to be courageous enough to say like, I also like to draw. I don't like to draw, but like, I don't know. There are people who like super artistic. There are people who like music. Like a lot of the entrepreneurs these days are at least like either DJs or they do like 2 other gigs on the side, right?
I think it was like Morgan Stanley or JP Morgan CEO. He's like a DJ on the side as well. Which is quite, so like on that topic, it's quite interesting because I think if you go back to our parents' generation or the generation before that, a lot of the roles were fairly historically, not much has changed. But I think the roles today, no one's done it before. And so essentially there's no playbook to how to do a job. And often you're hired based on your skill set and your past experiences. And being agile and being comfortable, being uncomfortable is something that they value. And so I fully understand where you're coming from. I think this kind of nicely ties to like your current role at Endeavor. So
one of the values of Endeavor is always agile, by the way.
Yeah. So I talk a lot about being comfortable being uncomfortable because you can't do, you know, the days of doing like a 9-to-5 job where you turn up every day is the same, you do the same thing over and over again, those days are probably long gone. Or at least if that's your job, you probably should think twice about what you want to do in the future. Those are jobs that are going to be taken up by, those are the things that can be automated, can be taken away. A lot of people worry about losing their jobs, etc. So if you do the same thing, and if it can be, it's very repetitive, it's going to go. It's probably started to go already. And so start doing things where there's no playbook and you kind of have to use your head and there's no playbook. And we'll come to some of your book recommendations in a second, because I was going to come to that in a second. But you're working at Endeavor, and Endeavor as an organization. So do you want to just quickly brief our listeners to what Endeavor does, and then we'll go a little bit more into entrepreneurship?
Yeah, sure. So Endeavor has been around for 27 years, started by Linda in Latin America. And the idea behind it was pretty much like, entrepreneurship is not just in Silicon Valley. Entrepreneurship exists everywhere in the world, but like, it just doesn't have the right tools and the right ecosystem and the, you know, the right framework around it to evolve and to grow. So she had this incredible kind of like insight in her mind, and she went and started this organization and supported entrepreneurs to grow in all these markets that were at that point emerging, and there was not like an entrepreneurial ecosystem in place. And sure. One thing that I really love about the like our theory is, you know, she says, like, when she was going to these markets, mainly Spanish-speaking markets, there was not even a word for entrepreneurship. Like, entrepreneurs didn't have a word to define themselves. And I come from Romania, which is a former communist country, which pretty much means that until, you know, for the time of communism, everything belonged to the governments. Like, it was state-owned. There was no private sector. It didn't exist. So I have a very similar experience of my parents starting this business pretty quickly after the fall of communism. And there was no word to define what they were doing. So, you know, when you go to school and they ask you what does your mom do? What does your dad do? I didn't know what to say that they're doing. And I remember, like, I was making up, because I would come home and I would ask them, what do you guys do? And they would be like, we're administrators, or like, you know, we're accountant, because my mom worked in accounting. So basically the whole organization is off by and for entrepreneurs, which pretty much means like, we want to support entrepreneurs in emerging markets, but now we're pretty like 42 markets, which is huge. And we're also in Europe, besides Latin America, we're in the Middle East, we're pretty much all over the world at this point, in the US as well. So the idea of the organization is we support entrepreneurs by giving them access to funding, by giving them access to mentors, access to talent, and really like connecting them and supporting them in their journey. One thing that differentiates us from a lot of other organizations that support entrepreneurs is that we believe in selecting people that have a multiplier effect potential, right? Which means you as an entrepreneur, Vinay, started an organization, but it's not just about you and the organization. It's about how many other entrepreneurs, startups, you know, bubbles you create around you. So it's about the people that you hire and then what they go on to do as well and what other organization they start. So we kind of like have these bubbles, like the multiplier effect bubbles of entrepreneurs, which I really love, because that shows like one entrepreneur that can create like 100 other, you know, entrepreneurs or businesses, or just multiply their effect to a point where the entire market, you know, grows and, you know, has like a positive impact. So that's why we call them high impact entrepreneurs as well. And their impact, as I said, is pretty spread. So it's not just financial, it's also like social, and it really can change. And we've seen that. We've seen these markets like really change and really grow based on the entrepreneurial ecosystem that was built. So that's a little bit of what the organization is doing.
Thank you so much, Beatrice. Okay, so quite a lot of our listeners are interested in entrepreneurship. So at least in the beginning, one of the hardest things to do is to find an idea or a problem that they can solve as a business. So in your opinion, are there any particular sectors, problems that you think are ripe for disruption or could benefit from entrepreneurs coming in 2024?
So it's so funny because everyone now talks about AI. It's kind of like the be all end all subject. And I mean, obviously AI has a very, very strong potential to disrupt a lot of the things, as you said, like a lot of the jobs that are too mechanical or too repetitive, and really like unlock our potential as a humanity. And I strongly believe in that. But I do think there's still, and obviously tech has always been like this great bubble of like, wow, like, you know, tech, like whatever you do, have a technical part or have like some sort of a tech. I do believe there's a lot of other industries that can be disrupted. Like, you know, I'm thinking here of like agriculture, of feminine care, or like feminine like health for women, which is still like very disproportionate in terms of like the amount of attention that it gets, but also like literally the amount of innovation and, you know, like the products that are coming up for supporting women and their health journeys. Agriculture, because I do think like we still have to, like, it doesn't matter how many new things we manage to do, like new meats or new whatever that are synthetic. But I think like we still need to invest in having that, you know, the food and the materials and like everything that you can get from agriculture. Transportation, to be honest, like I feel like we all live in big cities where we see that it's crazy, right? Like you still stay in traffic, you, like there's still like crazy accidents that are happening to infrastructure in a way. So I think like there's, you know, like we feel like because of the advances of technology and, you know, we have these flying cars and all these crazy things that are happening, we tend to feel like, wow, like everything has been done or we cannot do anything or like it's there. But like, I really believe that in every single sector of your life day to day, depending on where you are, I think it's very different if you're in India or if you're in Indonesia or if you're in Romania or if you're in New York or if you're in San Francisco or even like in a, I don't know, in Detroit or like another place in the US that's not like one of the major cities. You can innovate in something, in a journey or a user journey that you see that's not working well, like from, I don't know, the way you shop for, you know, your daily product to the way you get home or to the way you like, you know, do your different processes for work. And there can be like small innovations and big innovations. Sometimes I think tends like that small innovations are the ones that are having like a really big impact. So I really think like there's everything that can be still disrupted, not necessarily disrupted, just like made better. And it's also like a little bit of like sector specific and country specific. And region specific, like there's like a lot of things that in some countries are fully blown off and they're going really well, but then in other countries they're not yet. And, you know, it's still like a lot of work that you have to do, and you probably know that really well. And generally, like, you know, people, like I feel like it's and talent and new talent and what are we going to do with the new talent? You know, especially with the AI, like how are we, you know, like I have, as I said, I have a young daughter and I am terrified. Like, what is it going to happen? Like, is she still going to be able to be an artist if she wants to be an artist? Or is that going to become like a very different thing? Or is she, you know, will I train her to be an entrepreneur? Like, should I take her to like this school of like only doing like, you know, I mean, there's like this entrepreneurship academy, I think, that started in Amsterdam and it's now in Romania. And I met a group of students. They're all like super young, but they all already like had at least one business that failed. And they're like at the second business. And the way they pass each year is by proving that their business is profitable. I was like mind blown. Like, that's incredible. Like that, like, wow. They're like, if their academy is like that now, like, can you imagine like the impact that that's going to have on like the new entrepreneurs of tomorrow? And it was very funny talking with one of them. Like, he is basically, his business is around making better pillows.
Sure.
Like, you know, like small things, but like he, you know, he's super excited. So, and then there's like the whole, like, you know, world of like everything that has to do with the, you know, the not just the artificial intelligence, but like blockchain and, you know, that whole world. So I do think there's like a lot. Personally, if I would still go into something right now, and I hope, you know, a lot of people still think that they can change, I would find ways that are creating more solutions for not just climate change. I think it became a little bit of a word that like no one really believes anymore, but we still obviously have to think about that. But just like have a little bit more into like, okay, how can we change things, but in a way that has a good impact, not just on the people, but also on the planet, right? Like, how can we design a better way of doing healthcare, a better way of doing infrastructure, of doing tourism, you know, education, by having like a little bit of an, like caring about the planet as another player in this whole, you know, situation. Because we still need this planet to live on, and we only have one, so.
Yeah, Elon might disagree, but I understand exactly.
But he's doing a lot, like he started, I don't know now, probably he changed, but, you know, Elon was the first to start thinking into like, you know, how can we do it a bit better for the planet, so.
Yeah. I agree. I think this is an area that I've been thinking a lot about as well, because I get asked this quite a lot, and I've kind of come to three kind of very simple things to kind of look out for if you're looking to start a business. One is, you know, you got, can you do something that's better than what's already been done at the moment? Or the second option is cheaper. Can you do the same thing but cheaper? And the third option is basically ideally both. And if you can do it better and cheaper, then you're going to be onto something. But it's really interesting because a lot of things can be done in a very different way. So as an example, you know, if you ask 50 years ago, if you go back 50, 60 years ago, and you ask someone that was doing dishes, as an example, at home, and ask them, okay, what if we kind of solve this problem for you? You don't have to do dishes. The first thing they would have probably thought about is like, oh, let's get a robot that will wash the dishes. But then you kind of realize that actually having a dishwasher is a lot more efficient. So using that analogy, there's a lot of things where it's done in a very mechanical and a very inefficient way today that can be done in a very discreet and more efficient way that can be done. So as an example, I'm quite privileged in the sense that we work with over 2,000 companies around the world. And it's amazing to see some of the employers that we work with, to see some of the solutions. So one of the companies that we work with is actually working on flying cars at the moment. So it looks like a Batmobile. Anyone, check it out. It's got Bellwether. Really cool concept. I think their trailer just got released and it had like millions of views on YouTube. So really, really cool company. So it's just those kind of things where it's like mobility's gone from, you know, horses to cycles to cars to now airplanes and then, you know, faster cars. And now you're just kind of rethinking the whole thing and thinking, okay, what's the problem? We've got traffic, as we were talking about this just before the podcast, like traffic as an example. Okay, so what if we just completely like just get rid of the traffic problem and just fly through all of this? And so it's just really interesting, because how can you start doing things where the problem is just solved in a completely different way than what's been done at the moment? So that's quite interesting.
I think it's always like in line with that is like, what do you see as a thing that doesn't work, as a process that doesn't work, or what's something that, but like the first question that I would start with is, what do you deeply care of or like for? You know, what's something that really, really interests you? And the way to look at any new innovation is, you know, do you spend enough time looking into that problem with like a different perspective? Yeah. I think a lot of the super big innovations of this world were done by people that were just purely interested in very simple, as you said, dishwasher or like, you know, driving a car, or like they were very, very interested in different topics, and they were just able to look at them from a different perspective and see how they can be done better. And I 100%, I mean, banking, you know, like banking was a thing that we thought, wow, it's done. We have the banks, everything is great. But like now majority of our portfolio from the Endeavor entrepreneurs are in fintech, because in a lot of these emerging markets, the one thing that doesn't really work almost at all is banking. So, you know, they innovate on payments, they innovate on credit, they innovate on so many things. And just like, and we had like our honoree for our gala last year was David Vélez from Nubank, which is a new bank from Latin America. And, you know, he was telling us like he basically moved to a new country in Latin America and he just couldn't open an account. And that's what made me think like, this is not possible. Like it cannot, like this cannot be this hard to open an account in a bank, and it cannot be like so tedious and complex and so on. So, you know, that's how he started. Like he was working in investment. He had a great job. He wasn't like looking to become an entrepreneur and solve a huge problem, especially in a market like that was super emerging. But for him, it was like, this is a problem. Like, I'm sure other people have the same problem that I have. And I am sure that you can do this better. And now he's doing like, you know, amazing with Nubank and creating like a new way of banking. So for me, it's always that. Like what I wanted to do, for example, what was my business that for the time being, I would say it didn't fail. It just like it stopped, was to do better intimate care products for women out of materials that are not toxic. Why? Because I was looking around and everything that you had was super toxic, but they were just like, I mean, it's almost like, you know, tampons are OB. OB is a company, but it's like Uber, right? Like now Uber became like it's not just a brand. It's like your Ubering is like a whole, it's a verb. So it was the same, right? Like the product and the brand became so big that it was almost impossible for anyone to think you could actually have another product that's better than that product. But now, and this is like, almost 5 years later, there's so many new products. There's like so many, and like this whole conversation started around like, okay, like how can we do better products? Like, there has to be a way to do cleaner, better, nicer products that are good for the planet, but also they're good for our bodies, right? So I think in everything that you look at, like, you know, how can we do better clothes? How can we stop this craziness of like having, you know, like the whole clothing industry is one of the major impacting industry in terms of like climate and, you know, how it like dirties our environment. Like, we have to figure out to do it better. You know, like everything, like all these things, like we've came this way because we wanted to do, you know, we wanted to do more clothes cheaper, as you say. Yeah. And now we got to a point where like, okay, I think we've done enough of clothes cheaper. Like, let's figure out how we actually do, you know, maybe less clothes. Maybe
just
not
do
cheaper,
better now.
Do it better. And then the other thing is like, you know, like how do we figure out like how we work? Like there's so much discussion now about hybrid work because of the pandemic and all of this work. Like, do we work better in a hybrid way? Do we work better? Like, I would say, like, I was a big, you know, ambassador of working remote, because for me, it was always like, if you have a job that requires you to work with people from other countries, then it doesn't make sense for you to be in the office. Like, I mean, it makes sense in certain occasions where people come together and you brainstorm and you, but like, otherwise, like, I can be anywhere and work, because I won't, like, I won't have, you know, video, like video calling probably changed so much for us. But yeah, like I think every single, like it really starts with like, what are you interested in? What do you deeply care about? And also like, what really bothers you? Like,
sure.
You see something in your daily life that you're like, okay, like, I don't know, this milk is not okay. We need to like, or like anything, or like my coffee can be better, or my coffee cup can be better, or you can innovate on so many different things. And there's also like, talking about flexibility, I don't think these days you need to have that background. Like, I have a lot of friends that went into healthcare businesses, or, you know, businesses in which they weren't doctors, or they didn't have that background. Because you can learn, you can talk to people, you can get the knowledge. The knowledge is no longer like a prerequisite. I mean, you can go into to do like a law, like a type of like a innovate in law without you actually having practiced law. Because you see like a problem that you can fix, and you can find someone to give you like, oh, like you can find multiple people to advise you on like the more like technicalities of the job. And these days you can even be a coder without knowing how to code, you know? So
it
changes the game.
I think sometimes it gives you an advantage not coming from that background, because I guess you're not kind of weighed down by training in terms of just being told how to. You essentially have blinkers when you become an expert in an area.
Yes.
You kind of have blinkers on, you just do it in like without really looking at it, and coming from the outside from a very different perspective, it could be really, really helpful. So that's actually a really good point. I think from what you just said, I think what I can probably say is it's find things that frustrate you as a person.
Yeah.
And then that's probably a good place, because if you're frustrated, I'm pretty sure there are other people that have that similar feeling. And then if something could be done better on the back of that, that's probably a good place to start, I guess. That's interesting.
I'm a design thinking course facilitator, so I have to say, like, in design thinking we always say like you can start before you listen to the user, before you really go out there and you say, okay, I have this problem, do you have this problem, do you have this problem, like how many have this problem? And then like also like be a little bit aware of, because that gives you product market fit, as you know, it's one of the most important thing to have. But in the same time, I'm a little bit like, and I hope my colleagues won't hear this. There's a lot of innovation, starting with the car. Ford's story for me is like one of the most incredible stories. When he asked people if they want the car, they were like 100% no, because they didn't know what the car was, right? So, you know, like the story of him starting with the car and putting like the head of a horse, so that people would like buy the car because they would see the horse. So for me, like, that's also like a little bit of a, yes, you have to listen to the, like, and you kind of have to like do both. You have to come up with an idea. That's why I failed in a way, right? Because I was super sure that if I'm going to do this product out of hemp, that at the time, no one was really, like, it was starting to be a thing again, because it was a thing years before, but like no one was really, like, it was mainly associated with cannabis or like the drug, right? So when I was talking about like, oh, I want to do feminine care products out of hemp, people were like, what's that? And it was like, am I going to put that in my body? Will that be so? And even like, even now, like it's, I know a company that started kind of in the same time as I did, and they just launched some products, and it's still like, it's very hard to explain and to, so to train the people, right? And to make them feel like you actually need these, because so it's a lot of like education. Yeah. But unless you find that product market fit, and unless you figure out, like, maybe you don't do a product first, maybe you do like an app that teaches people about that certain problem, right? Because you might find that you have an amazing idea. People just don't understand what your idea is. They're super used to doing things the way they are doing it. And then they are refusing that idea, not because it's not great, but because they are afraid of like change and they don't understand it, right? So it's always like, it's very hard. And let's face it, entrepreneurs, I mean, how many entrepreneurs fail every year?
93%, according to stats, is 90% plus. So yeah, that's the thing.
The hardest job you can go for. Literally the hardest job.
You kind of have to have a certain threshold for pain, and and you kind of have to have you develop a thick skin. I think there's a whole different set of skill set that you develop as an entrepreneur. And I have a daughter as well, roughly the same age as yours. She's my daughter is 16 months old. And would I want my daughter to go through the same journey I had? Perhaps not. But would I want her to start a business and learn the skills from being an entrepreneur? I would say absolutely yes. I think sometimes being in a company, you just, you know, you sometimes, so my wife has a very traditional job. She started as an intern in that company and she's been there for over 10 years and she's a senior manager and it worked out really well for her. But the thing is you get told what is possible and what's not possible and you start accepting that in certain situations. And I think as an entrepreneur, you just refuse to take no as an answer. Or if someone says this can't be done, you're like, no, you're wrong. I'm going to figure out a way how to do this. That's the first thing as an entrepreneur. You get conditioned to do that where you kind of start thinking outside the box and you stop taking no for an answer. And I think that's a very good skill set to have.
You will soon realize that your daughter already knows that. So I feel like kids at this age, their favorite word is no. And for me, it's crazy to see how decisive. I mean, my daughter is 21 months, so a bit older. So she started speaking a little bit. And for me, like, it's a lesson because I look at her and I know all of us were like that. It's not special. It's like, this is developmental stages of humanity. And she's so, like, she knows. She knows when she's hungry. She knows when she's not. She knows when she wants to do something. Like, I feel like society and exactly what you said, like different working in different organizations or different jobs or different regimes or different, you know, like they start like to tame us.
Yeah,
and, like, make us think like we can do things, to be afraid, to like have all these like mentality type of I don't know, blockers.
Yeah,
but that's how we are. Like, we are born entrepreneurial. We are born wanting to do what we want to do. We are born thinking that no, I'm gonna push. Like, literally, she would go to something that she knows she's not allowed to do. She would look at me. She would be like, no, and she would do it.
Yeah.
And that's something beautiful to see as a parent, but also just like a human, because you get reminded of like, wow, like, no, that's how we are. We just become like afraid and we become like wanting to like go like with the norms and so on, because that's what society tells us that we have to do. So I think and it's a beauty, right? Like India, I think it's a great entrepreneurial country. US, it's an amazing entrepreneurial. But like, look at Romania, like, in Romania, when you go home and you tell, even me, like, my parents are entrepreneurs. When I went home after 10 years of like doing a more, you know, clear or like, I don't know, a traditional career path, and I said, I'm done, I want to become an entrepreneur. My parents were like, what happened? Why?
Yeah.
Did you lose your job? Like, you know, it's almost like it's seen as something that you do because everything else failed. So now you have to say that you're... It's crazy. Like, I feel like we need to change that, and we need to change that for our kids, for sure. And
I agree. I can speak to you about this for whole, like, you know, hours and hours. But I just have two quick questions, and then we'll kind of quickly wrap up. For me, I always ask my guest, Beatrice of today, what advice would you give to Beatrice of 20 years old?
That's such a good question. I never thought about it. To enjoy life more, to be more relaxed, and to trust the process a little bit more. I was really, really willing to draft, design, curate, and, you know, really like control the process a lot. I was a workaholic, like terrible workaholic. I had like, you know, at some point I was like sleeping 45 minutes or whatever. I think you know that very well.
Familiar with the concept.
Sure. So yeah, to take a little bit more breaks, to be more present, and to really trust the process more. That the process will like take you where it needs to, where you need to go, and not have like, I had these like 5 years plan, 10 years plans. I knew what I want to do by the time I was 25, by the time I was that. Obviously, you know, life plays with you a little bit, like kind of like you always like are proven that your plans are not necessarily what's going to happen. But that, like the fact that you want them to happen and you're so strict with kind of your vision, creates a lot of unnecessary pain.
And sure. You know,
so that's what I would tell her. I would still say that to Beatrice of 30 years because I feel like I'm still not learning those lessons.
I think sometimes you just get you get set in your ways, but also I think it's my wife who reminds me. She's just like, okay, but that's what made you who you are today.
Yeah.
And so if you are a lot more chill or a lot more kind of other things that you kind of wanted to be different, you wouldn't be the person that you are today, and yeah, you wouldn't be here sure. giving advice to the 20-year-old person.
No. So, I think one thing is for me, and probably you wouldn't give that advice to the 20 years old you, is to be more courageous and to really to go and do whatever ideas I had. I had so many, like I wanted to do so many ideas when I was 20 that it's crazy. I would still do them now. And for me, it's sure. like, why didn't I do it? And I didn't do it because I was, you know, I had this like, oh, I had to learn. I have to learn. I always thought that I need to learn and to know everything before I start something. And now I 100% would tell people, no, just start it. You're going to learn on the way.
I agree. I think that's a really good one. I think also in your early 20s, you have an advantage because you don't usually have like a mortgage. You don't have dependents. You don't have wife. You don't have kids. Yeah. You don't have spouses. And you know, I don't want to say you're very free without realizing that you're very free.
Yes.
And that gives you a lot of freedom that later on in life, it's much harder. Yeah. And, you know, when you're in your 30s, if you have a mortgage, you have kids, you have a partner, you have, you know, other life things, obligations, it's much harder to start a company. I got super lucky. You know, I would like to claim I'm a genius, but a lot of this just happened by luck. And you started a company in your 20s, not because I knew all of this, but now speaking to friends who are thinking about starting a company, they're just like, okay, they kind of have like, they feel like they're shackled. Because they have all these expenses, and your minimum amount to live for me when I was 20 was probably like £650. My rent was like X amount, and I could eat for like £70 a month. Okay, that's all I need. And then, but now if you're in your 30s and 40s, it's a lot higher. You're talking thousands, maybe even tens of thousands, depending on your lifestyle. To kind of give all of that up, it's very difficult. So,
although I would tell you that we have an amazing insights team, and we've kind of looked at our entrepreneurs, and we've did the Unicorn Founders Pathways studies, and we actually discovered that more and more entrepreneurs are actually starting in their 30s as opposed to their 20s.
So I think with funding and etc.
Like both. I think it's like the 100% everything you're saying, like I feel it very, very clear. Like, I mean, I took the leap when I was 30. I was still single, and I didn't have a mortgage. And I just, you know, I could leave New York because obviously New York is super expensive to live. And, you know, sure. I could leave New York. I could go back to my hometown and, you know, live, like stay in an apartment that didn't cost very much and eat like, I mean, food in general is not as expensive, especially, I mean, I don't know, I'm not, I can live with very little food. But the problem in your 30s, I think, becomes, wow, if I fail now, like, what am I going to do, right? Like, it's so much harder. But when in your 20s, and that's, I think for me, it was my job jumping or like my different trials with like different positions, because I wasn't that afraid of failing, because I knew like there's always like, okay, at 25, you can start from zero, from an internship anywhere, and it's going to be perfectly fine. You're still 25, right? Like at 35, you can't really start from being an intern. I mean, you can, but it's a bit harder on your ego, right?
Yeah,
So I think, like everything you said, but there is like a little, like, I feel like there's never too late. And that's something that I am still learning, because, you know, after I started the business and it didn't work out, I was like, I'm done. I have to find, like, you know, I'm already 35. It didn't work out. Like, what am I going to do? But like, in a way, if you look at like so many entrepreneurs, like a lot of them started in their 40s and, you know, they had a little different maturity and approach. And obviously, if you do have a job, a traditional job that pays the bills, and you're able to actually start something on the side and grow it, then it's also like a very different position, right? Because you're like, you're coming from a position where you can invest in your business or you can do a little bit more as opposed to a young person that has nothing. And it's just like, I mean, the drive is probably different, 20 versus 30, but also like the funding and the stability. So this is to say that I think both ways can work, but I think for, because probably your audience is more like 20s, I think for them, yeah, it's an amazing time to start and to try anything, like absolutely anything in the world and beyond.
I agree. I think the only thing I would probably just add to that is, you know, I made it sound like, you know, starting in your early 20s, being an entrepreneur in your early 20s is like the way to do it. Just to kind of counter at that point, I wish I worked somewhere for a few years, especially going through like a graduate program for 2 to 3 years. And there's a lot of mistakes that graduates or young people do in their career at workplace, you know, like certain types of emails. You just know what to say, what not to say, etc. I learned that the hard way. And, you know, I would have loved to make those mistakes while someone else was paying me. And then kind of like, jokes aside, I'm actually very serious about that, because I wish that a lot of the mistakes that cost us early on is completely avoidable. I get colleagues that are probably just work somewhere for a year or two and they come in, they're far smarter than I was. And they're not making the mistakes that I was making when I was 21, 22, just because they were trained in a certain way. And they kind of made those mistakes while someone else was paying them. And then they're starting their company and their companies are going to do a lot better because you're not making those silly mistakes in your, you know, as a 21-year-old. So either way, it works out really well.
What our report on Unicorn Founders Pathways is kind of showcasing, that a lot of the unicorns, you know, the entrepreneurs that actually get to, and that's very important. Of course, you can start a business, but that might not become a unicorn, or it might not go to a point where it's like a super, you know, impactful business or global or so on. So that's why the study kind of like looks a little bit into that. And, you know, what makes an unicorn, you know, pretty much. And it's exactly like what you're saying is pretty much what we're seeing, in the sense of like a lot of them have worked, not necessarily in like super corporate or like tech companies or something, but like for other entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
They worked for other entrepreneurs and they worked and they learned with them, with those other entrepreneurs, while them not being the main decision makers. So obviously they could learn and they could see what's good and what's not, and then go and do it better. So I think exactly what you're saying is pretty much something that comes out more and more. And then like there's something to say about education. I mean, I did this executive MBA at Stanford. Like, I wouldn't say that it teaches you things that you don't know. It's actually like not, because everything, like especially in the executive MBAs, like you learn a lot of like practical skills, so you actually look at case studies. But that's exactly what you said, right? You get to look into case studies, you get to look into like what people did good and what they didn't from an outsider perspective, learn from that, be able to analyze it and be able to think like, wow, if I'm in that position, what will I do different, right? So I'm not a huge advocate of traditional education, but I'm a huge advocate of this type of like and more like personal development. I think we as individuals have to continue to develop and to work and to learn and to study. And there's that, you never, and you probably know again this very well, I think you never know enough. You can always learn something new. And that's another thing, like when I finished school late, because I did a lot of school, and I finished like around 25, and I was like, I'm done with school. I don't want to like, and I feel like there's a lot of like mentality of like, I cannot wait to be done with school and go out into the world and do my own thing. And guess what? I am now 35 and I can't wait to go back and do another course or like learn, like, because it's not just about the book. Of course, you can read books, you can self-teach yourself anything. But when you go into these type of like programs, they're like experts, they're mentors, they're people that like are thought leaders, and they can show you tools and skills, and, you know, like they can model in a way that you might not be able to think about it yourself, right? So, and also like you meet people and you work with other people. And I think you learn also from like that interaction with other people. So I think for me, like always, like that's another advice, right? Like never stop learning, like always think about your learning process as something that's a continuous, like you invest, I think it's a very nice thing these days. We invest more and more in how we look, in, you know, being healthy, being fit and so on. The brain is also a muscle. You have to kind of do the same thing. Like you go to the gym every day. What do you do for your brain every day? You know, what do you do for your focus? What do you do for, you know, as an entrepreneur? I mean, you probably can talk about this more than ever. the main thing you have is yourself.
Yeah, I agree. It's just you and your head.
Yeah. So you have to continuously work on that, right? And yeah, like sometimes you will learn the hard way, but I'm sure that also you had a lot of opportunities to like work with incredible people and learn from other people and have mentors and so on. I think it's a game of entrepreneurship is a game. And that's why I love what Endeavor is doing, creating these ecosystems, right? Like it's a game of like having the right mentors, the right, you know, people that you can talk to, and then they can like teach you like, okay, I have this problem with hiring. What can I do? You know, what, like, you know, having that team of like advocates around you that can always like tell you like, you know, if you do this, this is what's going to happen. If you don't, and that's because they've either done it or they've seen 100 people doing it and they've learned from that, right? So yeah, I think it's a...
Yeah. So Beatrice, you worked with us and you've had interns from us in the past. Can you just briefly explain, it'll be great to kind of know a bit more about your experience from kind of start to the end, what that process looked like and was it useful for you?
Yeah. So I got contacted by Mandri about the opportunity. I was super happy because as it turns out, I worked with, you know, with MIST. So I knew about them as an organization. Mandri's fantastic. I mean, I'm happy that she feels the same about me, but I really like loved working with her. She's really like on point, because we really were looking for talent. We have this super busy time in the fall where we're organizing our fundraising gala, and we're always like looking for people that can come and join. So, and also like we're a global organization. So we love the idea that we can have interns from Saudi in particular. Everything, as I said, the experience was fairly easy in the communication sense. We had like really seamless communications and then great candidates. I'm sorry that a lot of them were like very fast to go, but like anyway, the candidate that we ended up with was really fantastic. We had a great relationship. I hope he learned just as much as, you know, we learned from him. And it was just like beautiful to have this type of like, normally schools would come in the summer or in like in the US, it's a very strict system where you only get them in their time off or things like that. It was beautiful to have something that was so well taken care of. I literally don't think I did anything more than saying, we want this person. And then I don't think I did anything else, which for me was great because it's just me and my team for now. I mean, it's just me doing fundraising. So, you know, having someone taking care of all these details and not having to like send letters and do all the logistics in the back and so on. And then getting like a global person coming and joining you in New York it was really great. So I'm super happy and I can't wait for the next internship.
Thank you so much, Beatrice. It's been fantastic having you on the podcast. To all our listeners, thank you so much for listening. Please do follow us on our social channels. All of the links are in the description. And we hope you have a great week. And we'll catch you next week at the next episode. And your regular host, Kalis, will be back. And thank you once again for having me on the podcast as a host. And hope everyone has a great week.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.